such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan, and passing away from there I was reborn elsewhere, and there too I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my nutriment, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan, and passing away from there I was reborn here. Thus, with their aspects and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lives. 39. This was the first true knowledge attained by me in the first watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished, and light arose, as happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 40. When my mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the passing away and rebirth of beings. With the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate. And I understood how beings fare on according to their actions thus. These beings who behaved wrongly by body, speech, and mind, who reviled the noble ones, held wrong view, and undertook actions based on wrong view, with the breakup of the body after death, have been reborn in a state of misery, in a bad destination, in the lower world, in hell. But these beings who behaved well by body, speech, and mind, who did not revile the noble ones, who held right view, and undertook action based on right view, with the breakup of the body, after death, have been reborn in a good destination, in a heavenly world. Thus, with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and being reborn, inferior and superior, beautiful and ugly, fortunate and unfortunate, and I understood how beings fare on according to their actions. 41. This was the second true knowledge attained by me in the middle watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished, and light arose, as happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. 42. When my mind was thus concentrated, purified, bright, unblemished, rid of imperfection, malleable, wieldy, steady, and attained to imperturbability, I directed it to knowledge of the destruction of the taints. I directly knew as it actually is, this is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, this is the way leading to the cessation of suffering. I directly knew it as it actually is. These are the taints. This is the origin of the taints. This is the cessation of the taints. This is the way leading to the cessation of the taints. 43. When I knew and saw thus, my mind was liberated from the taint of sensual desire, from the taint of existence, and from the taint of ignorance. When it was liberated, there came the knowledge, it is liberated. I directly knew. Birth is destroyed. The spiritual life has been lived. What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. 44. This was the third true knowledge attained by me in the last watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose. As happens in one who dwells diligent, ardent, and resolute. But such pleasant feeling that arose in me did not invade my mind and remain. From Majjhima Nikaya, 36, Mahasaka Sutta, 1, 240 through 249. Verse 3, The Ancient City. Monks, before my enlightenment, while I was still a bodhisattva, not yet fully enlightened, it occurred to me, alas, this world has fallen into trouble. in that it is born, ages, and dies. It passes away and is reborn. Yet it does not understand the escape from this suffering, headed by aging and death. When now will an escape be discerned from this suffering headed by aging and death? Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does aging and death come to be? By what is aging and death conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is birth, aging and death comes to be. Aging and death has birth as its condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does birth come to be? Existence, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense bases, name and form, by what is name and form conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is consciousness, name and form comes to be. Name and form has consciousness as its condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what exists does consciousness come to be? By what is consciousness conditioned? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is name and form, consciousness comes to be. Consciousness has name and form as its condition. Then, monks, it occurred to me, this consciousness turns back. It does not go further than name and form. It is to this extent that one may be born and age and die, pass away and be reborn. That is, when there is consciousness with name and form as its condition, and name and form with consciousness as its condition. With name and form as condition, the six sense bases. With the six sense bases as condition, contact. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Origination. Origination. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. Then, monks, it occurred to me, when what does not exist does aging and death not come to be? With the cessation of what does the cessation of aging and death come about? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is no birth, aging and death does not come to be. With the cessation of birth comes cessation of aging and death. It occurred to me, when what does not exist does birth not come to be? Existence, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense bases, name and form. With the cessation of what does the cessation of name and form come about? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is no consciousness, name and form does not come to be. With the cessation of consciousness comes cessation of name and form. It occurred to me, when what does not exist does consciousness not come to be? With the cessation of what does the cessation of consciousness come about? Then, monks, through careful attention, there took place in me a breakthrough by wisdom. When there is no name and form, consciousness does not come to be. With the cessation of name and form comes cessation of consciousness. Then, monks, it occurred to me, I have discovered this path to enlightenment. That is, with the cessation of name and form comes cessation of consciousness. With the cessation of consciousness comes cessation of name and form. With the cessation of name and form, cessation of the six sense bases. With the cessation of the six sense bases, cessation of contact. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Cessation, cessation. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. Suppose, monks, a man wandering through a forest would see an ancient path, an ancient road traveled upon by people in the past. He would follow it and would see an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks, groves, ponds, and ramparts, a delightful place. Then the man would inform the king or a royal minister, "Sire, know that while wandering through the forest I saw an ancient path, an ancient road traveled upon by people in the past. I followed it and saw an ancient city, an ancient capital that had been inhabited by people in the past, with parks, groves, ponds, and ramparts, a delightful place. Renovate that city, sire." Then the king or royal minister would renovate the city, and some time later, that city would become successful and prosperous, well populated, filled with people, attained to growth and expansion. So too, monks, I saw the ancient path, the ancient road traveled by the perfectly enlightened ones of the past. And what is that ancient path, that ancient road? It is just this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. I followed that path, and by doing so I have directly known aging and death, its origin, its cessation, and the way leading to its cessation. I have directly known birth, existence, clinging, craving, feeling, contact, the six sense bases, name and form, consciousness, volitional formations, their origin, their cessation, and the way leading to their cessation. Having directly known them, I have explained them to the monks, the nuns, the male lay followers and the female lay followers. This spiritual life, monks, has become successful and prosperous, extended, popular, widespread, well proclaimed among devas and humans. Samyutta Nikaya 12:65 2 104 through 107. Part 4. The decision to teach. 19. I considered, this Dhamma that I have attained is profound, hard to see and hard to understand, peaceful and sublime, unattainable by mere reasoning, subtle, to be experienced by the wise. But this population delights in attachment, takes delight in attachment, rejoices in attachment. It is hard for such a population to see this truth, namely, specific conditionality, dependent origination. And it is hard to see this truth, namely, the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. If I were to teach the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. Thereupon, there came to me spontaneously these stanzas never heard before. Enough with teaching the Dhamma, that even I found hard to reach, for it will never be perceived by those who live in lust and hate. Those died in lust, wrapped in darkness, will never discern this abstruse Dhamma, which goes against the worldly stream, subtle, deep and difficult to see. Considering thus, my mind inclined to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. 20. Then, monks, the Brahma Sahampati knew with his mind the thought in my mind, and he considered, the world will be lost, the world will perish, since the mind of the Tathagata, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one, inclines to inaction rather than to teaching the Dhamma. Then, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his flexed arm, or flex his extended arm, the Brahma Sahampati vanished in the Brahma world and appeared before me. He arranged his upper robe on one shoulder, and extending his hands in reverential salutation toward me, said, "Venerable sir, let the Blessed One teach the Dhamma. Let the Sublime One teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who are perishing through not hearing the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand the Dhamma. The Brahma Sahampati spoke thus. And then he said further, In Magadha there have appeared till now impure teachings devised by those still stained. Open the doors to the deathless. Let them hear the Dhamma that the stainless one has found. Just as one who stands on a mountain peak can see below the people all around, so, O wise one, all-seeing sage, ascend the palace of the Dhamma. Let the sorrowless one survey this human breed, engulfed in sorrow, overcome by birth and old age. Arise, victorious hero, caravan leader, debtless one, and wander in the world. Let the blessed one teach the Dhamma. There will be those who will understand. 21. Then I listened to the Brahma's pleading, and out of compassion for beings I surveyed the world with the eye of a Buddha. Surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties, with good qualities and with bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach, and some who dwelled seeing fear and blame in the other world. Just as in a pond of blue or red or white lotuses, some lotuses that are born and grow in the water thrive immersed in the water without rising out of it. And some other lotuses that are born and grow in the water rest on the water's surface. And some other lotuses that are born and grow in the water rise out of the water and stand clear, unwetted by it. So too, surveying the world with the eye of a Buddha, I saw beings with little dust in their eyes and with much dust in their eyes, with keen faculties and with dull faculties, with good qualities and with bad qualities, easy to teach and hard to teach, and some who dwelled seeing fear and blame in the other world. Then I replied to the Brahma Sahampati in stanzas, Open for them are the doors to the deathless. Let those with ears now show their faith. Thinking it would be troublesome, O Brahma, I did not speak the Dhamma subtle and sublime. Then the Brahma Sahampati thought, The Blessed One has consented to my request that he teach the Dhamma, and after paying homage to me, keeping me on the right, he thereupon departed at once. 22. I considered thus, To whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? It then occurred to me, Alara Kalama is wise, intelligent, and discerning. He has long had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to Alara Kalama. He will understand it quickly. Then deities approached me and said, Venerable Sir, Alara Kalama died 7 days ago, and the knowledge and vision arose in me. Alara Kalama died 7 days ago, I thought. Alara Kalama's loss is a great one. If he had heard this Dhamma, he would have understood it quickly. 23. I considered thus, To whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? It then occurred to me, Uddaka Ramaputta is wise, intelligent, and discerning. He has long had little dust in his eyes. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to Uddaka Ramaputta. He will understand it quickly. Then deities approached me and said, Venerable Sir, Uddaka Ramaputta died last night, and the knowledge and vision arose in me. Uddaka Ramaputta died last night, I thought. Uddaka Ramaputta's loss is a great one. If he had heard this Dhamma, he would have understood it quickly. 24. I considered thus, To whom should I first teach the Dhamma? Who will understand this Dhamma quickly? It then occurred to me. The monks of the group of five who attended upon me while I was engaged in my striving were very helpful. Suppose I taught the Dhamma first to them. Then I thought, Where are the monks of the group of five now living? And with the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, I saw that they were living at Varanasi and the deer park at Isipatana. 25. Then, monks, when I had stayed at Uruvela as long as I chose, I set out to wander by stages to Varanasi, between Gaya and the Bodhi. The Ajivaka Upaka saw me on the road and said, "Friend, your faculties are clear. The color of your skin is pure and bright. Under whom have you gone forth, friend? Who is your teacher? Whose Dhamma do you profess?" I replied to the Ajivaka Upaka in stanzas, "I am one who has transcended all, a knower of all, unsullied among all things, renouncing all, by cravings ceasing freed, having known this all. For myself, to whom should I point as teacher? I have no teacher, and one like me exists nowhere in all the world, with all its devas, because I have no person for my counterpart. For I am the Arahant in the world. I am the teacher supreme. I alone am a perfectly enlightened one, whose fires are quenched and extinguished. I go now to the city of Kasi, to set in motion the wheel of Dhamma. In a world that has become blind, I go to beat the drum of the deathless." By your claims, friend, you ought to be the universal victor. The victors are those like me, who have won the destruction of taints. I have vanquished all evil states. Therefore, Upaka, I am a victor. When this was said, the Ajivaka Upaka said, "May it be so, friend." Shaking his head, he took a bypath and departed. 26. Then, monks, wandering by stages, I eventually came to Varanasi, to the deer park at Isipatana, and I approached the monks of the group of five. The monks saw me coming in the distance, and they agreed among themselves thus, "Friends, here comes the ascetic Gotama who lives luxuriously, who gave up his striving and reverted to luxury. We should not pay homage to him, or rise up for him, or receive his bowl and outer robe. But a seat may be prepared for him. If he likes, he may sit down." However, as I approached, those monks found themselves unable to keep their pact. One came to meet me, and took my bowl and outer robe. Another prepared a seat, and another set out water for my feet. However, they addressed me by name and as friend. 27. Thereupon I told them, "Monks, do not address the Tathagata by name and as friend. The Tathagata is an Arahant, a perfectly enlightened one. Listen, monks, the deathless has been attained. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma, practicing as you are instructed. By realizing it for yourselves here and now through direct knowledge, you will soon enter and dwell in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness." When this was said, the monks of the group of five answered me thus, "Friend Gotama, by the conduct, the practice, and the performance of austerities that you undertook, you did not achieve any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones. Since you now live luxuriously, having given up your striving and reverted to luxury, how could you have achieved any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones?" When this was said, I told them, "The Tathagata does not live luxuriously, nor has he given up his striving and reverted to luxury. The Tathagata is an Arahant, a perfectly enlightened one. Listen, monks, the deathless has been attained. From the home life into homelessness." A second time, the monks of the group of five said to me, "Friend Gotama, how could you have achieved any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones?" A second time I told them, "The Tathagata does not live luxuriously. From the home life into homelessness." A third time, the monks of the group of five said to me, "Friend Gotama, how could you have reached any superhuman distinction in knowledge and vision worthy of the noble ones?" 28. When this was said, I asked them, "Monks, have you ever known me to speak like this before?" "No, venerable sir," Monks, the Tathagata is an arahant, a perfectly enlightened one. Listen, monks, the deathless has been attained. I shall instruct you. I shall teach you the Dhamma, practicing as you are instructed, by realizing it for yourselves here and now through direct knowledge. You will soon enter and dwell in that supreme goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the home life into homelessness. 29. I was able to convince the monks of the group of five. Then I sometimes instructed two monks while the other three went for alms, and the six of us lived on what those three monks brought back from their alms round. Sometimes I instructed three monks while the other two went for alms, and the six of us lived on what those two monks brought back from their alms round. 30. Then the monks of the group of five, thus taught and instructed by me, being themselves subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, attained the unborn supreme security from bondage, Nibbana, being themselves subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to aging, sickness, death, sorrow, and defilement, seeking the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. They attained the unaging, unailing, deathless, sorrowless, and undefiled supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. The knowledge and vision arose in them. Our liberation is unshakable. This is our last birth. Now there is no more renewed existence. From Majjhima Nikaya, 26. Ariyaparyesana Sutta 1.167 through 173. Part 5. The First Discourse. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling at Varanasi in the deer park at Isipatana. There the Blessed One addressed the monks of the group of five thus. Monks, these two extremes should not be followed by one who has gone forth into homelessness. What two? The pursuit of sensual happiness in sensual pleasures, which is low, vulgar, the way of worldlings, ignoble, unbeneficial, and the pursuit of self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, unbeneficial. Without veering toward either of these extremes, the Tathagata has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, and leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana. And what, monks, is that middle way awakened to by the Tathagata? It is this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This, monks, is that middle way awakened to by the Tathagata, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, and leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to Nibbana. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of suffering. Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, illness is suffering, death is suffering. Union with what is displeasing is suffering. A separation from what is pleasing is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. In brief, the five aggregates subject to clinging are suffering. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. It is this craving that leads to renewed existence, accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there. That is, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, craving for extermination. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. It is the remainderless fading away and cessation of that same craving, the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-attachment. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. It is this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right concentration. This is the noble truth of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of suffering is to be fully understood. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of suffering has been fully understood. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This is the noble truth of the origin of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the origin of suffering is to be abandoned. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the origin of suffering has been abandoned. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This is the noble truth of the cessation of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the cessation of suffering is to be realized. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the cessation of suffering has been realized. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This is the noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering is to be developed. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. This noble truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering has been developed. Thus, monks, in regard to things unheard before, there arose in me vision, knowledge, wisdom, penetration, and light. So long, monks, as my knowledge and vision of these four noble truths as they really are in their three phases and 12 aspects was not thoroughly purified in this way, I did not claim to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world with its devas, Mara, and Brahma. In this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its devas and humans. But when my knowledge and vision of these four noble truths as they really are in their three phases and 12 aspects was thoroughly purified in this way, then I claimed to have awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment in this world with its devas, Mara, and Brahma, in this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its devas and humans. The knowledge and vision arose in me. Unshakable is the liberation of my mind. This is my last birth. Now there is no more renewed existence. This is what the Blessed One said. Elated, the monks of the group of five delighted in the Blessed One's statement. And while this discourse was being spoken, there arose in the Venerable Kondanya the dust-free, stainless vision of the Dhamma. Whatever is subject to origination is all subject to cessation. And when the wheel of the Dhamma had been set in motion by the Blessed One, the earth-dwelling devas raised a cry. At Varanasi, in the deer park at Isipatana, this unsurpassed wheel of the Dhamma has been set in motion by the Blessed One, which cannot be stopped by any ascetic or Brahmin or deva, or Mara or Brahma, or by anyone in the world. Having heard the cry of the earth-dwelling devas, the devas of the realm of the four great kings raised a cry, At Varanasi, this unsurpassed wheel of the Dhamma has been set in motion by the Blessed One, which cannot be stopped by anyone in the world. Having heard the cry of the devas of the realm of the four great kings, the Tava Timsa devas, the Yama devas, the Tusita devas, the devas who delight in creating, the devas who wield power over others' creations, the devas of Brahma's company, raised a cry. At Varanasi, in the deer park at Isipatana, this unsurpassed wheel of the Dhamma has been set in motion by the Blessed One, which cannot be stopped by any ascetic or Brahmin or Deva, or Mara or Brahma, or by anyone in the world. Thus, at that moment, at that instant, at that second, the cry spread as far as the Brahma world, and this 10,000-fold world system shook, quaked, and trembled, and an immeasurable great radiance surpassing the divine majesty of the devas appeared in the world. Then the Blessed One uttered this inspired utterance. Kondanya has indeed understood. Kondanya has indeed understood. In this way, the Venerable Kondanya acquired the name Anya Kondanya. Kondanya who has understood. Samyutta Nikaya 56.11 Dhamma Kaka Pava Tana Sutta 5.420-424 Chapter 3 Approaching the Dhamma Introduction One of the most distressing predicaments any earnest, open-minded spiritual seeker might face is the sheer difficulty of choosing from among the bewildering diversity of religious and spiritual teachings available. By their very nature, spiritual teachings make claims upon our allegiance that are absolute and all-encompassing. Adherents of a particular creed are prone to assert that their religion alone reveals the final truth about our place in the universe and our ultimate destiny. They boldly propose that their path alone offers the sure means to eternal salvation. If we could suspend all belief commitments and compare the competing doctrines impartially, submitting them to empirical tests, we would have a surefire method of deciding between them, and then our ordeal would be over. But it isn't that simple. Rival religions all propose, or presuppose, doctrines that we cannot directly validate by personal experience. They advocate tenets that call for some degree of trust. So as their tenets and practices clash, we run up against the problem of finding some way to decide between them and negotiate their competing claims to truth. One solution to this problem is to deny that there is any real conflict between alternative belief systems. The adherents of this approach, which we might call religious universalism, say that at their core all spiritual traditions teach essentially the same thing. Their formulations may differ, but their inner core is the same, expressed differently, merely to accord with different sensibilities. What we need to do, the universalist says, when faced with different spiritual traditions, is to extract the kernel of inner truth from the pods of their exoteric creeds. From ground level, our goals look different, but from the heights we will find the goal is the same. It is like the view of the moon from different mountain peaks. Universalists, in matters of doctrine, often endorse eclecticism in practice, holding that we can select whatever practices we prefer and combine them like dishes at a buffet. This solution to the problem of religious diversity has an immediate appeal to those disillusioned with the exclusive claims of dogmatic religion. Honest critical reflection, however, would show that on the most vital issues, the different religions and spiritual traditions take different standpoints. They give us very different answers to our questions concerning the basic grounds and goals of the spiritual quest, and often these differences are not merely verbal. To sweep them away as being merely verbal may be an effective way of achieving harmony between followers of different belief systems, but it cannot withstand close examination. In the end, it is as little tenable as saying that because they have beaks and wings, eagles, sparrows, and chickens are essentially the same type of creature, the differences between them being merely verbal. It is not only theistic religions that teach doctrines beyond the range of immediate empirical confirmation. The Buddha, too, taught doctrines that an ordinary person cannot directly confirm by everyday experience. And these doctrines are fundamental to the structure of his teaching. We saw, for example, in the introductions to chapters 1 and 2, that the Nikayas envisage a universe with many domains of sentient existence, spread out in boundless space and time. a universe in which sentient beings roam and wander from life to life on account of their ignorance, craving, and kama. The Nikayas presuppose that throughout beginningless time, Buddhas without number have arisen and turned the wheel of the Dhamma, and that each Buddha attains enlightenment after cultivating spiritual perfections over long periods of cosmic time. When we approach the Dhamma, we are likely to resist such beliefs and feel that they make excessive demands on our capacity for trust. Thus, we inevitably run up against the question whether, if we wish to follow the Buddha's teaching, we must take on board the entire package of classical Buddhist doctrine. For early Buddhism, all the problems we face in deciding how far we should go in placing faith can be disposed of at a single stroke. That single stroke involves reverting to direct experience as the ultimate basis for judgment. One of the distinctive features of the Buddha's teaching is the respect it accords to direct experience. The texts of early Buddhism do not teach a secret doctrine, nor do they leave scope for anything like an esoteric path reserved for an elite of initiates and withheld from others. According to text 3.1, secrecy in a religious teaching is the hallmark of wrong views and confused thinking. The teaching of the Buddha shines openly, as radiant and brilliant as the light of the sun and moon. Freedom from the cloak of secrecy is integral to a teaching that gives primacy to direct experience, inviting each individual to test its principles in the crucible of his or her own experience. This does not mean that an ordinary person can fully validate the Buddha's doctrine by direct experience without special effort. To the contrary, the teaching can only be fully realized through the achievement of certain extraordinary types of experience that are far beyond the range of the ordinary person enmeshed in the concerns of mundane life. However, in sharp contrast to revealed religion, the Buddha does not demand that we begin our spiritual quest by placing faith in doctrines that lie beyond the range of our immediate experience. Rather than ask us to wrestle with issues that, for us in our present condition, no amount of experience can decide, he instead asks us to consider a few simple questions pertaining to our immediate welfare and happiness, questions that we can answer on the basis of personal experience. I highlight the expression, for us in our present condition, because the fact that we cannot presently validate such matters does not constitute grounds for rejecting them as invalid or even as irrelevant. It only means that we should put them aside for the time being and concern ourselves with issues that come within the range of direct experience. The Buddha says that his teaching is about suffering and the cessation of suffering. This statement does not mean that the Dhamma is concerned only with our experience of suffering in the present life, but it does imply that we can use our present experience, backed by intelligent observation, as a criterion for determining what is beneficial and what detrimental to our spiritual progress. Our most insistent existential demand, springing up deep within us, is the need for freedom from harm, sorrow, and distress, or, positively stated, the need to achieve well-being and happiness. However, to avoid harm and to secure our well-being, it is not sufficient for us merely to hope. We first have to understand the conditions on which they depend. According to the Buddha, whatever arises, arises through appropriate causes and conditions, and this applies with equal force to suffering and happiness. Thus, we must ascertain the causes and conditions that lead to harm and suffering, and likewise, the causes and conditions that lead to well-being and happiness. Once we have extracted these two principles, the conditions leading to harm and suffering, and the conditions leading to well-being and happiness, we have at our disposal an outline of the entire process that leads to the ultimate goal, final liberation from suffering. One text offering an excellent example of this approach is a short discourse in the Anguttara Nikaya, popularly known as the Kalama Sutta, included as text 3.2. The Kalamas were a people living in a remote area of the Ganges Plain. Various religious teachers would come to visit them, and each would extol his own doctrine and tear down the doctrines of his rivals. Confused and perplexed by this conflict of belief systems, the Kalamas did not know whom to trust. When the Buddha passed through their town, they approached him and asked him to clear away their doubts. Though the text does not specify what particular issues were troubling the Kalamas, the later part of the discourse makes it clear that their perplexities resolved around the questions of rebirth and karma. The Buddha began by assuring the Kalamas that under such circumstances, it was proper for them to doubt, for the issues that troubled them were indeed common sources of doubt and perplexity. He then told them not to rely on 10 sources of belief. 4 of these pertain to established scriptural authority, oral tradition, lineage of teaching, hearsay, and collections of texts. 4 to rational grounds, logic, inferential reasoning, reasoned cogitation, and the acceptance of a view after pondering it. And 2 to authoritative persons, impressive speakers and respected teachers. This advice is sometimes quoted to prove that the Buddha rejected all external authorities and invited each individual to fashion his or her own personal path to truth. Read in context, however, the message of the Kalama Sutta is quite different. The Buddha is not advising the Kalamas, who, it must be stressed, had at this point not yet become his own disciples, to reject all authoritative guides to spiritual understanding and fall back solely on their personal intuition. Rather, he is offering them a simple and pragmatic outlet from the morass of doubt and perplexity in which they are immersed. By the use of skillful methods of inquiry, he leads them to understand a number of basic principles that they can verify by their own experience, and thereby acquire a sure starting point for further spiritual development. Always underlying the Buddha's questions and their replies is the tacit premise that people are primarily motivated to act by a concern for their own welfare and happiness. In asking this particular set of questions, the Buddha's purpose is to lead the Kalamas to see that even when we suspend all concern with future lives, unwholesome mental states such as greed, hatred, and delusion, and unwholesome actions such as killing and stealing, eventually redound to one's own harm and suffering right here and now. Conversely, wholesome mental states and wholesome actions promote one's long-term welfare and happiness here and now. Once this much is seen, the immediately visible harmful consequences to which unwholesome mental states lead become a sufficient reason for abandoning them, while the visible benefits to which wholesome mental states lead become a sufficient motivation for cultivating them. Then, whether or not there is a life after death, one has adequate reasons in the present life to abandon unwholesome mental states and cultivate wholesome mental states. If there is an afterlife, one's recompense is simply that much greater. A similar approach underlies text 3.3, in which the Buddha demonstrates how present suffering arises and ceases in correlation with present craving. This short sutta, addressed to a lay follower, concisely articulates the causal principles that lies behind the Four Noble Truths, but rather than doing so in the abstract, it adopts a concrete, down-to-earth approach that has a remarkably contemporary appeal. By using powerful examples drawn from the life of a layman deeply attached to his wife and son, the sutta makes a deep and lasting impression on us. The fact that such texts as this sutta and the Kalama Sutta do not dwell on the doctrines of karma and rebirth does not mean, as is sometimes assumed, that such teachings are mere cultural accretions to the Dhamma that can be deleted or explained away without losing anything essential. It means only that, at the outset, the Dhamma can be approached in ways that do not require reference to past and future lives. The Buddha's teaching has many sides, and thus from certain angles it can be directly evaluated against our concern for our present well-being and happiness. Once we see that the practice of the teaching does indeed bring peace, joy, and inner security in this very life, this will inspire our trust and confidence in the Dhamma as a whole, including those aspects that lie beyond our present capacity for personal verification. If we were to undertake certain practices that require highly refined skills and determined effort, we would be able to acquire the faculties needed to validate those other aspects, such as the law of karma, the reality of rebirth, and the existence of supersensible realms. See Text 7, 4, 23 through 24, and Text 7, 5, 19 through 20. Another major problem that often besets spiritual seekers is the demands that teachers place upon their capacity for trust. This problem has become especially acute in our own time, when the news media gleefully spotlight the frailties of numberless gurus and jump at the chance to show up any modern-day saint as nothing better than a swindler in robes. But the problem of rogue gurus is a perennial one by no means peculiar to our age. Whenever one person exercises spiritual authority over others, it is only too easy for that person to be tempted to exploit the trust others place in him in ways that can be seriously detrimental to himself and his disciples. When a pupil approaches a teacher who claims to be perfectly enlightened and thus capable of teaching the path to final liberation, the pupil must have some criteria at hand for testing the teacher to determine whether the teacher truly measures up to the lofty claims he makes about himself, or that others make about him. In the Vimamsaka Sutta, Text 3-4, the Buddha lays down guidelines by which a monk can test the Tathagata, that is, the Buddha, to evaluate his claim to be perfectly enlightened. One benchmark of perfect enlightenment is freedom of the mind from all defilements. If a monk cannot directly see into the Buddha's own mind, he can nevertheless rely on indirect evidence to ascertain that the Buddha is freed from defilements. That is, by evaluating the Buddha's bodily deeds and speech, he can infer that the Buddha's mental states are exclusively pure, uninfluenced by greed, hatred, and delusion. In addition to such observational inference, the Buddha further encourages the monk to approach him and directly inquire about his mental states. Once the pupil gains confidence that the Buddha is a qualified teacher, he then puts the master to the ultimate test. He learns his teaching, enters upon the practice, and penetrates the Dhamma by direct knowledge. This act of penetration, here equivalent at minimum to the attainment of stream entry, brings the gain of invincible faith, the faith of one who is established upon the irreversible path leading to final release. Taken in isolation, the Vimamsaka Sutta might give the impression that one acquires faith only after gaining realization of the teaching, and since realization is self-validating, faith would then become redundant. This impression, however, would be one-sided. The point the sutta is making is that faith becomes invincible as a result of realization. Not that faith first enters the spiritual path only when one attains realization. Faith is the first of the five spiritual faculties, and in some degree, as trusting confidence in the Buddha's enlightenment and in the main principles of his teaching, it is a prerequisite for the higher training. We see faith functioning in this preparatory role in Text 3-5, a long excerpt from the Kankhi Sutta. Here, the Buddha explains that a person who has faith in something preserves truth when he says, "This is my faith." He preserves truth because he merely states what he believes without jumping to the conclusion that what he believes is definitely true and anything else contrary to it false. The Buddha contrasts the preservation of truth, sakkanurakkhana, with the discovery of truth, sakkanubodha, which begins by placing faith in a teacher who has proved himself worthy of trust. Having gained faith in such a teacher, one then approaches him for instruction, learns the Dhamma, practices it, according to a series of steps more finely calibrated than in the preceding text, and finally sees the supreme truth for oneself. This does not yet mark the end of the road for the disciple, but only the initial breakthrough to the truth, again corresponding to the attainment of stream entry. Having achieved the vision of truth, to reach the final arrival at truth, sakkanupatti, that is, the attainment of arahantship or final liberation, One must repeat, develop, and cultivate the same series of steps until one has fully absorbed and assimilated the supreme truth disclosed by that initial vision. Thus, the entire process of training in the Dhamma is rooted in personal experience. Even faith should be rooted in investigation and inquiry, and not based solely upon emotional leanings and blind belief. Faith alone is insufficient, but is the door to deeper levels of experience. Faith serves as a spur to practice. Practice leads to experiential understanding, and when one's understanding matures, it blossoms into full realization. Chapter 3. Approaching the Dhamma. Part 1. Not a secret doctrine. These three things, monks, are conducted in secret, not openly. What three? Affairs with women, the mantras of the Brahmins, and wrong view. But these three things, monks, shine openly, not in secret. What three? The moon, the sun, and the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata. Anguttara Nikaya, 3, 129, 1, 282 through 283. Part 2. No dogmas or blind belief. Thus have I heard. On one occasion the Blessed One was wandering on tour together with a large sangha of monks when he arrived at a town of the Kalamas named Kesaputta. Now the Kalamas of Kesaputta heard. It is said that the ascetic Gotama, the Sakyan son who went forth from a Sakyan family, has arrived at Kesaputta. Now a good report about that master Gotama has been circulating thus. That Blessed One is an Arahant, perfectly enlightened, accomplished in true knowledge and conduct, fortunate, knower of the world, unsurpassed leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of devas and humans, the enlightened one, the blessed one. Having realized with his own direct knowledge this world with its devas, Mara and Brahma, this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, with its devas and humans, he makes it known to others. He teaches a Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. With the right meaning and expression, he reveals a spiritual life that is perfectly complete and purified. Now it is good to see such Arahants. Then the Kalamas of Kesaputta approached the Blessed One. Some paid homage to him and sat down to one side. Some exchanged greetings with him and, after their greetings and cordial talk, sat down to one side. Some saluted him reverentially and sat down to one side. Some remained silent and sat down to one side. Then the Kalamas said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, some ascetics and Brahmins who come to Kesaputta explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of others. But then some other ascetics and Brahmins come to Kesaputta, and they too explain and elucidate their own doctrines, but disparage, debunk, revile, and vilify the doctrines of the others. For us, Venerable Sir, there is perplexity and doubt as to which of these good ascetics speak truth and which speak falsehood. It is fitting for you to be perplexed, O Kalamas. It is fitting for you to be in doubt. Doubt has arisen in you about a perplexing matter. Come, Kalamas. Do not go by oral tradition, by lineage of teaching, by hearsay, by a collection of texts, by logic, by inferential reasoning, by reasoned cogitation, by the acceptance of a view after pondering it, by the seeming competence of a speaker, or because you think the ascetic is our teacher. But when you know for yourselves, these things are unwholesome, these things are blamable, these things are censured by the wise, these things, if undertaken and practiced, lead to harm and suffering. Then you should abandon them. What do you think, Kalamas? When greed, hatred, and delusion arise in a person, is it for his welfare or harm? For his harm, Venerable Sir. Kalamas, a person who is greedy, hating, and deluded, overpowered by greed, hatred, and delusion, his thoughts controlled by them, will destroy life, take what is not given, engage in sexual misconduct, and tell lies. He will also prompt others to do likewise. Will that conduce to his harm and suffering for a long time?
Yes, venerable sir.
What do you think, Kalamas? Are these things wholesome or unwholesome?